Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on Monday afternoon. Those of you who are used to hearing a different theme song, you should know that we are in the process of picking a new theme for Political Rewind. Every day this week, our team behind the scenes gets to pick a song they think would make a good one. That was Lisa Clark's selection. Producer Lisa Clark. I honestly don't know what that song is, so you'll let me know, won't you, Lisa? On Wednesday, Tyler Morris, our board operator, will pick a song. And then Friday, Jenny Hammett, our senior producer. So we'll see. One of those songs might work. I don't know about that one, Theron Johnson.
In here. Migos. That'll be really, that's upbeat for our listeners.
That's Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, who joins us. We're really glad you could be here today, Theron. Also, Brian Robinson, Republican political consultant. He and Theron have had an act going for a long time, and we're always glad when we can pair them up on this show. It's always interesting to hear the two of them talk about politics from their different perspectives. Jim Galloway, of course, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays. What did you think of that as a theme song?
I'm leaning right now. This is we're 3 days past crossover day. I'm leaning St. James Infirmary.
St. James Infirmary. And joining us from the Washington Bureau of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, their Washington correspondent, Tamar Hallerman. Tamar, thank you for being with us.
Thanks. I was kind of digging the new theme song.
You were? All right, good. Well, we'll see how things develop this week. We have some breaking news that we'll be talking about a little later in the show. As expected, President Trump signed a new executive order, a new immigration order that refines to some extent the initial order that caused so much controversy. This one is it's a little different, but the critics are already saying it's not. It's just a different version of a Muslim ban. So we'll get to that a little later. Also, the Supreme Court today vacated an order. They had been looking at taking up the case of a transgender student in Virginia who had won in the district courts down there the right to use the bathroom of his sexual orientation, the one that he identifies with. And the Supreme Court had planned to take that case up, or we thought they might. And they today said that because the Trump administration, in fact, rescinded the federal order on transgender bathrooms in schools, they were going to kick it back to the courts. So a lot happening today. But let's start with the big weekend news. And let's go back just a bit, if I may. I want to set the stage, if I may. Last Tuesday night, we know that President Trump gave a speech to a joint session of Congress that was received better than certainly anything else he has done before since becoming president. Democrats said that they thought the speech was presidential in nature. They took issue with a number of things that he said in terms of truthfulness. They also took issue with some of the programs that he outlined in very, very vague generalities. And it looked like the administration was on a path towards getting some things accomplished. The next day, Jeff Sessions, the news broke that Jeff Sessions had, in fact, talked to the Russians, contrary to what he had told a congressional committee during his confirmation hearing. And suddenly that became a big, big story. It led the attorney general to declaring he would have to recuse himself from any cases, or I'm sorry, any investigation of the possible interference of Russia in our elections or of a Trump-Russian connection in terms of the elections. Right so far, Jim?
So far, so good.
So,
which brings us to 6:35 Saturday morning.
Yeah, let me read you what the Washington Post says about just that. We are told by Friday afternoon, when President Trump was getting set to go to Mar-a-Lago, here's how the Post characterizes it. Trump was mad, steaming, raging mad. Trump's young presidency has existed in a perpetual state of chaos. The issue of Russia is distracted from what was meant to be his most triumphant moment, his address last Tuesday to a joint session of Congress. And now his latest unfounded accusation that Barack Obama tapped Trump's phones during last fall's campaign had been denied by the former president and doubted by both allies and fellow Republicans. He made that tweet actually Saturday morning. The Post tells us, though, he went to Mar-a-Lago already very, very angry. Trump enters week 7 of his presidency, the same as the 6 before it, enmeshed in controversy while struggling to make good on his campaign promises. At the center of the turmoil, an impatient president increasingly frustrated by his administration's inability to erase the impression that his campaign was engaged with Russia to stem leaks about both national security matters and internal discord and to implement any signature achievements. And it didn't get any better over the weekend, did it, Jim?
No, it didn't. No, there were, what, 5 tweets that morning? Last one was about Arnold. and that was probably the most civil one.
Yeah. Tamar, let me bring in you. As you pointed out, as we were getting set for the show today, most members were back in their districts for the weekend, so they're only kind of slowly coming back up into up to the Hill this afternoon, this evening, getting set to business up there. But what's the mood starting to feel like as you walk around the hills of the around the halls of the Capitol today?
People were not tipped off that this was coming, and I think even his allies didn't know what to do with it when it did come up. You know, all of a sudden they're supposed to defend this, and it felt like it sort of came out of left field. So there was it was met with a lot of silence, at least initially, as Republicans were figuring out how they wanted to respond to all of this. And still there are a lot who are kind of trying to keep this at arm's length. There are a few critical Republicans who are saying, okay, yeah, let's fold this into our ongoing investigation of Russian potential Russian meddling in this election. But there are a lot who are saying, I don't want to be anywhere near this.
Theron, for a president of the United States to accuse another president of wiretapping, of tapping him, what's your thought about that?
You know, I think what we're seeing is we're really seeing this guy who is unhinged and who is unraveling right before our eyes in number 45. To make a baseless, non-factual, false statement that the former president of the United States of America was actually wiretapping your phones, it was just a blatant lie. And what was so hilarious is that his own allies, his own staff, may I add, Bill, went on national television yesterday and basically could not even defend it and basically said that it wasn't true. But let's just talk about what's really going on here. Donald Trump, to me, is the master of diversion. He will create sort of a storm on the left to totally divert from what's going on the right. And what's truly going on is his inability to govern, his inability to lead this country, to get things done as he promised on the campaign. So I think that this is the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency. I think we should start saying it on this show, and Brian knows this, is that President Pence is going to be on his way to put his hand on the Bible and to be sworn in as our next president, because I think that this guy is just totally, totally insane.
Brian, are you going to be part of that inauguration coverage with us?
I think the question here is, why are we not more outraged that President Obama wiretapped Trump Tower? We should be up in arms about this because this is illegal. He broke the law.
Wait, tweeted
it. He tweeted it must be true. We know that he would not have tweeted it if it wasn't true, right? I'm kidding, obviously.
Thank God.
But I don't understand the strategy here. He is a master of diversion. He's done this stuff very well in the past to keep the news that he didn't want to see becoming big from being the top story in the New York Times. That matters to him as a Manhattanite, what's in the New York Times. And he's able to move the news around that way. I'm confused on this one, though, because the repercussions of such a charge are so big and will do so much to go straight at his credibility that I don't know how you bounce back. And I did notice on the Sunday shows yesterday that the Republican surrogates who were on were sort of danced around the issue a little bit, and they were like, let's look into it. I think that's the right answer for Republicans right now. As Lindsey Graham said in his town hall, hey, this is a serious charge. Let's look into it, and then let there be repercussions later.
Jim, I know you want to jump in, but while we've got Brian setting us up for this, let's listen to an exchange that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, one of those Trump surrogates, had yesterday on ABC's This Week, Martha Raddatz was hosting, and this was the brief back and forth.
If this happened, if this is accurate, this is the biggest overreach and the biggest scandal.
The president of the United States is accusing the former president of wiretapping him.
I think that this is, again, something that if this happened, Martha, I agree.
Why is the president saying it did happen?
Okay, let me toss two theories out
here. Sure.
Two theories in which this may make a modicum of sense. Number one, Donald Trump started his political career by building around the antipathy toward Barack Obama among a certain class of voters. And as things have gotten a little bit out of hand, he is going back to that same well. All right? It's not pretty, but it does unify his people, his base. And you'll notice that this kind of feeds into the deep state conspiracy theory that you've already heard kind of mentioned by Steve Bannon and Steve Miller and the likes. The other thing I think this might do is also it allows these congressional investigations to proceed in a way that Trump can frame without hurting himself. He can say these investigations are looking at one aspect, even if they're looking at something totally different.
So, it's interesting. You're creating a certain equivalency that an investigation by the Intelligence Committee, well, we're going to look at Russia and Trump. Maybe there was something there. But, you know, we're also, while we're at it, going to look at Obama and his wiretapping.
If I could, but Nuntz on the House chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has pretty much already bought into this.
He said, yes, that he wants to look into it. But you know what? Theron, let me get you first, and then I want to ask you tomorrow. I want to get you in another part of this conversation. So here's the thing, though, Theron. The New York Times in January, January 19th, did do a story talking about how intelligence agencies, among others the FBI, they had sources from the intelligence community that at least three Trump campaign advisors seem to have had links with Russia. They were investigating. It was Paul Manafort. It was Carter Page. It was Roger Stone. And one official told the Times that intelligence reports based on some wiretap communications had been provided to the White House. So that doesn't say Trump, but you can understand why there might be some confusion over what's really going on here, right?
Well, let's also make sure that we say that one of those people that you mentioned had to resign as chairman of the campaign.
Absolutely.
Because it had gotten so bad. Listen, the process that the federal government has to go through in order to get a wiretap, let's just really pause for a second. That means that you have to take evidence that illegal activity is happening in this campaign headquarters, i.e. the Trump Towers, and then you have to present that sufficient evidence to a federal judge. That federal judge then has to grant the wiretap. And so this whole notion, which I don't believe that President Obama intentionally put a wiretap into the Trump Towers, but if it hypothetically did happen, that means that there was illegal activity going on. There was clearly illegal and inappropriate conversations going on with a foreign hostile. And people had to resign from their posts. And we also see the attorney general, who, by the way, lied under oath, who said he had no communications with Russia. To me, to your point, Bill, that's the big problem here, is that Donald Trump is lying about this assertion, this claim that his phones were wiretapped in order to divert exactly what Jim was saying, to really fire up this birther issue again, like in Obama, and to really fire up his base.
All right. Brian, get a quick response in there.
It seems like paranoia, but it's not paranoia if they really are out to get you. And I do think that there is a vast network of people trying to bring Donald Trump down. I do think that's true. And whether it's people who are in the bureaucracy who are doing all of these leaks, whether it's media elites who are shocked and outraged by his every utterance, I don't think that him tweeting on Saturday morning about that was a good idea. Let me say that. I don't think it was a good idea. But I do think that there's this underlying thing that is driving him, is that people are trying to destroy him. And eventually you just constantly lash out. And that's what we're seeing is him getting into this foxhole and just lashing.
All right. Tamara, the Wall Street Journal this morning had an editorial. The headline on it was, Washington goes nuts. The political brawl over Russia, the Trump campaign, and U.S. intelligence has reached the point where basic questions about U.S. institutions and trust in government are at stake. Democrats are trying to capitalize on anonymous leaks based on U.S. intelligence, and the president is responding with a fusillade of unproven accusations. So, Tamar, there is no baseline of truth anymore, right? And it's leading us to look at, to filter anything that previously, say during Watergate, might have been treated as a line over which you cannot go. There's no such thing anymore. It's all fair game for political partisanship. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it very hard to do journalism when we can't agree, you know, on the definition of the word is or the word the. And certainly when you know when half the population doesn't trust the government and work that comes out of the government, that makes it really hard. You know, whose facts or statistics can you even cite that are, you know, trustworthy that aren't deemed fake news? So, yeah, it makes it really tough.
And it also makes it hard. What, Jim, people are taking sides based on partisan loyalty, not based on any kind of examination of what might actually be happening here.
Right, right. And that makes what the FBI is doing, what the courts might ultimately do, so very much important. I mean, every now and then you do have an incontrovertible fact pop out. And we had a couple pop out this week. And I think one of the more important one was J.D. Gordon. He was a Trump aide during the campaign who had previously said that in Cleveland, during the Republican National Committee, he had nothing whatsoever to do with an amendment to the Republican Party platform that stripped the provision that said that recommended giving Ukraine armed weapons to defend itself
against Russia,
against a Russian incursion. And well, what happened this weekend? He said, "Yeah, I did it, and yeah, Paul Manafort made me."
So where does this leave us, everybody? If we no longer are able to agree on what is a fact, you know, let me go back to Watergate. I mean, it did take a while before. I mean, there were Nixon partisans who, for a good period of time, refused to accept the president's role in the Watergate scandal that unfolded. But at a certain point, the facts overwhelmed any partisanship at all, and President Nixon went down. I don't get the sense that there is a line like that that's up ahead for anybody. I'm not suggesting Trump should resign like Nixon did. Just the comparison of where do we accept facts for fact's sake and take the partisanship out of them.
Well, look, people didn't turn on Richard Nixon the day that Woodward and Bernstein started writing about Watergate. It took a long period of time before it began to congeal in the public's mind that something was amiss, that something had been done wrong. And that could be what we're looking at here, if in fact the facts come out, as Jim said, and they paint a bad picture for the people who are in the Trump campaign and their communications with Russian agents of any sort. So I do think that there's a line you can cross. And here's what you need to look for as far as what Republicans are going to do is, what are Trump's approval numbers with Republican voters? Right now, they're extraordinarily strong. They like what he's doing. No, Theron's looking at me funny. With Republicans, Trump's numbers are great. He's not doing great with independents and Democrats, certainly. But with Republicans, they're strong. And if that ever changes, then you will see your Republican leaders in the House and Senate begin to change their tune.
But therein lies the problem, is when you have Brian Robinson, who's a Republican strategist, coming on this radio show and basing his facts, or maybe alternative facts, on whether or not how popular.
What was an alternative fact?
Basing it on how popular the president is with Republican voters, whether they're college educated or non-college educated. To answer your question, Bill, we are a country right now that's extremely divided. Now, you can say all of what you want to say about when President Obama came in. Yes, we were divided, but we were probably more so along the lines of race. This president has divided this country, And what's happening is, to your point about fake news, when he can just make these assertions and no one calls him on it, when people call him on it, he just throws it away as just fake news. It is very un-American.
All right, let's listen. I went out, you know, we believe, at least we think, I think, Tamar, I'm right, that we think Trump got this idea about the wiretaps from first from the Mark Levin radio show, syndicated radio show, which was then picked up by Breitbart. Isn't that what we think is probably what happened here?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
So I thought, well, let me go back to the show at which Mark Levin talked about this, about the Obama administration tapping Trump phones. And I thought you should hear a little bit of it. And I wanted to take the start, the introduction to the show, and then you'll go from there to hearing him lay out this charge, Levin, because we don't listen. Most of us aren't listening to this show, I don't think. But I thought you'd like to get a sense of the show based on how it's introduced, and then hear what Levin says.
Now, broadcasting from the underground command post, deep in the bowels of a hidden bunker, somewhere under the brick and steel of a nondescript building, we've once again made contact with our leader, Mark Levin.
Their desire to destroy this administration, or anyone who would have beaten Hillary Clinton, is insatiable. There's a bigger scandal here, folks. And this is what I want to walk you through again. There is a much bigger scandal here. We have a prior administration. Barack Obama and his surrogates, who were supporting Hillary Clinton and their party, the Democrat Party, who were using the instrumentalities of the federal government, intelligence activities, to surveil members of the Trump campaign and to put that information out in the public. Those are police state tactics.
All right, Mark Levin. Tamar, this is a guy who we believe the president listens to, at least with some regularity, yeah?
Yep.
Well,
go ahead.
I lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
Okay, Jim.
Well, first of all, let me say that that sounded a whole, at the beginning, sounded a whole lot like Terminator 3. But the other thing that this bespeaks of, I think, and Mark Levin kind of hit at it, you've got a president who hasn't been able to seize the leadership of his own government yet, and he's getting very frustrated by that. And the problem is when doing that, you have to meet. It's not simply commanding a federal government to do what you want. You have to kind of meet hundreds of thousands of federal workers halfway, and that hasn't been happening. They haven't even filled out the ranks of the people that are supposed to tell these federal employees what to do.
And I think that's I think that's kind of at the root of it. This is a man whose experience has been in the business world, where as a head of an organization, you can get stuff done a lot easier. You can snap your fingers and things can start to happen. Whereas government, the gears turn really, really slowly. You have to get 535 members of Congress to green light a lot of these things with all these disparate interests. And I think he's super frustrated. You see this time and time again on the campaign trail. People make really bold promises about how we're going to do X and Y, make huge changes to taxes or healthcare or what have you, and people always discover how hard it is. And,
well,
and you see that with healthcare. You see that with taxes with Trump.
And Tamar, I'm glad you brought that up, because we have to take a quick break right now. But when we come back, we do need to talk about how what happened over the weekend may have an impact on some pretty important initiatives that the Trump administration and the Republican leadership on the Hill, like ACA, like repeal and replace, are going to deal with that coming up. But it's already 2:30, and we really need to get a break in. Let's do it right now.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Tamar Hamilton, the AJC's Washington correspondent, joins us from Washington, D.C. Jim Galloway, the political writer of AJC, is here. And so are Theron Johnson, Democratic strategist, and his buddy, Brian Robinson, Republican strategist. You guys really have done a pretty good job getting out there and, you know, going at each other in a positive way and, you know, in a number of different venues, including this one, frankly.
Yeah. The secret is, you know, I invite Brian over with some of my African-American friends and let him be uncomfortable, and he invites me with some of his white, you know, friends, and I'm uncomfortable. So we're both, expanding our comfort zone.
You can join the conversation, as many people already have today, by tweeting us at PoliticsGPB. Dave, who tweets at Vinoy Tapas, says, Trump believes Breitbart over the director of the FBI. This is a disgrace to the office. Thought Crime says, is Clapper an unimpeachable choice? Clapper, of course, former NSA guy, said that Trump was wrong, that there never had been any surveillance of Trump Tower. Thought Crime tells us that he thinks that's a bad source of knowledge. And Ted Barfield, one of our favorite tweeters, who I'm glad he listens because he never seems to like anything we do on the show. But he says people are taking sides based on partisanship, ... You mean people like journalists? So thank you for those. By the way, we should also point out, Lisa, you've already seen this. Catherine Cummings says, sure hope the Wednesday and Friday music options are strong improvements over today's. Can't think of a kinder way to say this. That was Troll March by Mr. Scruff, Lisa just told us. All right, Tamar, I want to get serious again. We think that the leadership, the Republican leadership, are going to really start rolling out their plan for repeal and replace this week. Does it look like they'll be able to really start moving on that, or has Trump set them back with this firestorm?
I think they'll be able to get moving on it, and their strategy is an interesting one. They're essentially just going to throw out their plan and essentially dare Republicans to vote against it. There's a lot of there are a lot of differences. You have your moderates who are a little scared about anything that they think could. You know, go against Planned Parenthood, things that, you know, that they think there could be political repercussions. And then you have your conservatives who are worried that the tax credits that are going to be a part of this replacement plan are akin to a new entitlement program. So you have some hesitancy on both sides, and you have Republican leaders essentially making this gamble that, you know what, for the last 6-8 years, we said we hated Obamacare. This is our chance, and you better darn well vote for it.
Tamar, if I could ask you, what's the coverage gap? I mean, is there any? Have there been any estimates yet as to how much the Republican, how many people the Republican plan would cover versus how much the ACA is covering right now?
We don't have exact numbers yet. I think conventional wisdom is that it'll be less than what Obamacare was because you're taking away the mandates that everybody, including young health people or young healthy people, have to buy insurance. An interesting tidbit that came out over the weekend is that all of this last-minute tinkering that was happening was because the initial estimate from the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan budget scorekeeper, showed that the coverage gap would be quite large. So they were trying to shrink that a little bit over the weekend.
Brian, the people on the Republican side of the aisle who are really putting up the strongest resistance are those really conservative members who are upset that apparently, although we don't know, they've kept this plan under lock and key. Nevertheless, we do suppose it's correct that there will be a tax credit, a refundable tax credit involved. And there are a lot of Republicans, including the Koch brothers, saying this will not fly. It just makes this another entitlement. It's the last thing we need. Yes?
Well, of course, because that refundable tax credit they're referring to means that people would get back more money than they even paid in taxes or were due in taxes. So it really is giving people money. That said, Speaker John Boehner, the former speaker, recently said, look, Republicans in 20 years have never agreed on health care reform. We've never been able to come to an agreement. We're not unique in that sense. You may recall that Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama and Harry Reid were breaking arms and cutting sort of skeezy deals like the Nebraska Compromise or the Nebraska Kickback in 2009 for Obamacare. It was really hard for them to agree. Bernie Sanders wanted a single payer. So they didn't agree either, but they squeezed it past the finish line by squeezing their members, many of whom lost their seats over that vote, I might add. So Republicans face a tough challenge in agreeing on this step forward. I agree with Speaker Boehner that it won't be a full repeal and replace. It'll be a remix and rebrand and sort of fix some of the big problems that are in Obamacare and call it something different.
You know, Theron, it's interesting because Brian just made the case, which is correct, that the Democrats have really shoved this down the throats of all of their members, passed it on a completely partisan vote, not a single Republican, and it's very likely, and we know that as a result of that, this has never been, ACA was never embraced broadly in a bipartisan way, the way you might want legislation like that to work, and is what led to Republican attacks on Obamacare for so long. And here we go. Republicans are now about to do, apparently, the same thing in reverse.
Absolutely. And Brian and I, we argue about this, but, you know, when folks turn on their television sets and they see these protesters at these town hall meetings in these very conservative Republican districts, Brian likes to say that, oh, Democrats actually bust in, you know, hundreds and hundreds of white Democrats in states like Utah.
Yes.
No, the problem is that their base, which, by the way, Donald Trump spent his entire campaign running against the establishment Republican base, is now responding and saying, okay, you promised us a repeal or replace, or if you're going to repeal and replace this Affordable Care Act that's actually working for 20 million American people, then what are you going to do with it? So I think that, yes, you're going to see a front row seat to partisan politics in Washington. What Democrats have got to do is that we cannot take our foot off the gas. We've got to take our message about how the Affordable Care Act has worked for 20 million Americans, how a lot of these people in these Republican districts who are recipients of this new health care plan are outraged about it, and I think we've got to continue to organize on it.
Yeah, I think Republicans have enough strength in Congress to do the teardown. What they might not have is enough strength to do the rebuild. And if you recall, when the ACA was passed, I think the Senate Democratic majority, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they had 60 members then. Did they not?
But then they lost one. Remember, Scott Brown replaced Kennedy. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right.
So,
that's right. But they were close to that bulletproof majority.
But they didn't have it, and that's why they had to do it through this budget trick called reconciliation, which
is how Republicans are starting to unwind Obamacare.
Absolutely. We should do every dirty trick that they did. We should do the nuclear option. We should do budget reconciliation. We should do everything that they did and just sort of cackle and laugh as we're doing it because they brought this on themselves and they totally deserve it. And Theron's wrong. This is not working for 20 million Americans. If it was, it would be even harder to rebuild, as Jim called it, because we have 100% premium increases all over the country this year.
No.
We have
one example of a state that has a dramatic, I mean, I'm frankly don't have the statistics at my disposal, but there's one state. The average increase has been about 25%,
which is a lot.
Oh, it's a
That's
lot.
Not working.
But it's not 100%.
That's not
okay. But.
Another turn of fact.
You're seeing dramatic increases across the country. You're seeing the exchange in many counties only offering one plan or two plan. There's no competition, so the provider sets the price. If you are in that income bracket that allows you to get a subsidy on the exchange, you're not rich enough to pay for these increases.
You know what's interesting to me, Tamar, is Brian is talking about this so enthusiastically. It strikes me the first reason would be because he's not going to be up for re-election in 2018.
Right, yeah.
There is a sense in which the Democrats have been holding ACA like this fragile crystal bowl that they're kind of teetering with. They're afraid it's going to drop, but now the Republicans come along, they're going to grab it, and when they break it, they own it. Yeah, isn't that why some of the enthusiasm among Republicans on the Hill isn't quite what Brian's expressing here?
Exactly. I think people realize that, wait, oh, now this is on our backs. You know, one important thing to note, we mentioned budget reconciliation, the special process they're going to use to peel back, you know, to knock down Obamacare, so repeal it and then hopefully replace it. You know, it requires 51 votes instead of 60, so the Democrats can't filibuster. But Republicans do need to win over 8 Democrats to get the biggest parts of the replacement plan in place. And that's something that I think people aren't properly thinking through right now. You know, Democrats right now are showing that they're willing to sit back and, you know, they don't seem to want to help Republicans on this. But if Republicans want this replacement plan to last, if they don't, you know, when Democrats come back into power eventually one day, that they don't immediately kill whatever Republicans replace it with, you know, they should get Democrats on board so that it'll be more of a bipartisan thing. And I wonder if we are setting ourselves up for a similar battle in 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, whenever Democrats get back
in power. Come on, Brian. Step back into this. what do Republicans do to get 8 Democratic votes? When you might have even Republicans kind of hesitant to cast it.
I would pair it with candy. That's what you always, that's what you have to do.
Make it
really hard. Pair the tough stuff with the easy stuff. That's going to be great if you're a North Dakota Democrat, for example.
You know what, Brian? I think that you make an interesting point. It kind of a little bit facetiously, but Theron.
Not facetiously.
All right, fine. You mean, all right. So with that in mind, Theron, Chuck Schumer. Minority leader in the Senate, Pelosi in the House, they've made it pretty clear we're going to do the same thing to Republicans they did when we had more power in the Senate. Particularly, we're going to be obstruct when Obama was in the White House. We're not going to go along with anything they do. And yet, at the same time, Democrats say, "Well, ACA, there are lots of things we could do to improve it." What is preventing these two sides, aside from the lockdown positions they're in, from getting together and saying, okay, Democrats admitting, we got some problems, we're ready to fix them, we're ready to work with you, we don't care. The former president has said he doesn't care if it's called Obamacare or not. Why don't Democrats want to get engaged and try to make this a better bill?
Well, I think it's politics. But if you really listen to what Senator Schumer said over the weekend, he did say that, let's be fair, that Democrats are going to, quote-unquote, lock down and be in opposition of a plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. But the problem, Bill, is that until we actually see what that plan is, because let's not forget, Donald Trump won a lot of these Rust Belt states, particularly Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, because he promised to repeal and replace Obamacare. And so I think what Democrats have got to do is that we've now got to say, okay, once this plan is introduced, which it will be soon by Secretary Price, then what are we going to be able to compromise on? One of the things that have gotten a lot of pushback is the whole part in the healthcare bill and plan that allows people to the age of 26 to stay on their parents' health care. You know, what are you going to do with people who have pre-existing conditions? And so once this plan comes out, I think then Democrats are going to have to pivot, and then you're going to see more messaging towards, okay, what's a compromise that can work for the American people?
What do we think the timetable is tomorrow? Do we have any sense of this at all this week?
Yeah, so we're expected to see a draft later this week, and we'll see the committees in the House start to work on it. But leaders in the House are pretty optimistic we could see something on the floor later this month. An important thing to note, though, is that right now, House Speaker Paul Ryan is relying on only Republican votes to pass this plan, which means he has very little room for error. He can afford to lose only about 30 Republicans on this plan before he has a problem. And so I'm going to be closely watching the Freedom Caucus and the Republican Study Committee, the two very conservative arms of the House, to see if any of them come out against it. They're under big pressure from groups like the Heritage Foundation and some of these Koch brother-aligned groups to oppose this plan. And do they stick with it? Because if they oppose it, then that means Obamacare stays the land of the law.
Tamar, let me ask you. We not too long ago, we got word that Barry Loudermilk had left the Freedom Caucus. Does that kind of peg him as a supporter of the Paul Ryan plan?
unclear at this moment. He still is staying involved with the Republican Study Committee, which is a group that the Freedom Caucus had kind of formed off on. I'm not necessarily reading it as him becoming more moderate in any way. So I don't know.
All right. So, Jim, tomorrow, you two may have the most insight about this. Buried in that Washington Post piece that I read the first couple of graphs from about the fury of President Trump this weekend was an interesting couple of paragraphs. It talked about HHS Secretary Tom Price being on the road with Vice President Pence. The White House has, of course, been accused of being at, they just don't know where they're spinning their wheels. They have not offered the Republican leaders on the Hill much help in how they want the plan to unfold. So apparently the Post points out that there was a meeting at the White House that included Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget, meeting with, I think, Steve Bannon and others about what the plan would be that they would support. And Price had no part in it. And the Post does wonder if he's been sidelined in any way. Have you gotten any reporting on this tomorrow?
I don't know why that decision was made about Tom Price, but I can try and riff off of it a little bit. And it's kind of interesting. I don't know if he did anything again to get out of favor, but getting Mick Mulvaney into the frame makes sense to me for two reasons. First of all, right now, we're playing a numbers game. I mentioned earlier getting the number from the Congressional Budget Office to see how many people would get coverage under this Republican replacement plan. So numbers right now are absolutely critical in being able to sell this to Republican members. Second of all, Mick Mulvaney was a founding member of the Freedom Caucus. So he has a lot of relationships with these Republicans who matter. And a lot of these Freedom Caucus members are going to be looking at the administration. They're going to be looking at what Trump thinks about this Republican plan from Capitol Hill before they make their decision. So it makes a lot of sense to have Mick Mulvaney there. At the same time, you know, Tom Price is Mr. Healthcare. That's why they hired him in the first place. So it's pretty amazing. I don't know whether, you know, he just happened to be out of town at the moment where they needed him and they just kind of temporarily brushed him to the side, or if he did something wrong. But he still is a very powerful friend in Speaker Paul Ryan. And Speaker Ryan was saying how much the replacement plan was going to mirror Tom Price's replacement plan. So I'm not going to write him off yet.
Okay.
No, but it does look like what you've got is a dynamic building that where you have Price aligned with Paul Ryan, which would be only natural, and then you have the Freedom Caucus trying to kind of build some sort of bridges to the Trump administration to see if that's where it can exercise its own clout.
Well, Theron, we're going to have to take a break, but before we do, anything that the White House does to weigh in on health care is better than nothing, which is where they've been at so far.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that the President Obama, was sort of really able to put the Republicans in the box and saying, okay, you know, you want to do away with it, but you've tried to repeal it unsuccessfully for all this time. So, you know, I think I agree that I think something is really going on with Secretary Price kind of being left out. I mean, he was supposed to be this new architect, this guy that's going to put together this phenomenal repeal and replace option. And so, you know, I just think at the end of the day, I hope that this president will take the Democratic input and really, unlike what Brian says, just take in consideration these 20 million people who are happy that they have Obamacare.
All right. We got to get our second break of the show out of the way because it's already 2:50 on Monday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, Samantha Bee, the host and co-creator of the TBS satirical news show Full Frontal, and Joe Miller, co-creator and head writer. The show takes a comedic feminist perspective on politics and is focused lately on the Trump administration. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back, Jim Galloway, Tamar Hallerman from the AJC, Brian Robinson, and Theron Johnson at the table today. By the way, breaking news just before we came into the studio, Barbara Streisand And this is apropos of the fact tomorrow happens to be National Pancake Day. She tweeted, Donald Trump is making me gain weight. I start the day with liquids, but after the morning news, I eat pancakes smothered in maple syrup. Take that, Brian Robinson.
Hey, I was celebrating that diet long before Trump, so I don't know.
All right. Jim Galloway, what's happening up in the 6th District? Two newsworthy items, and we will say, as we always do for transparency, one of the candidates is working with our friend Brian Robinson here, and they have some news to report, don't they?
Right. We have got the two of the kind of the Republican heavyweights. If we you don't want to decide who's the front runner
right.
yet.
It's a little early.
Yeah. You've got Marco Rubio endorsing Judson Hill,
who you're working with, Brian.
Yep.
And of course, the significance there is that Rubio took the 6th district in the presidential primary last year, running first to, I think, Donald Trump second and Kasich third, if I'm not right.
Yeah, I think that was right.
Yeah.
But Marco won it by a pretty wide margin.
Yeah, he did. He was a pretty good fit for the congressional district. You also had Dan Moody, former state senator, representing District 56. And he is a self-funder. He's a businessman. He's threatening to put a lot of his own cash into this contest. He's out with his own 30-second. It's a minute spot, is it not? It's a minute spot, and it's done by Fred Davis. And Fred Davis has a tremendous history in this state.
Yes,
good
he
and
does.
Bad.
Good and bad.
He went after Roy Barnes pretty heavily, right?
Yeah, with
King
the,
Rat.
With the King Rat video. Yes, Bob Barr will not swear by him because there was something with
Bob Barr is just gooder.
Yeah,
that was the
yeah, and ponies and mm-hmm. ribbons and it just didn't work out.
If you go to the Political Insider blog, you can scroll down and you'll see you've got a link to that Dan Moody.
Right,
spot.
Right. Yeah, and this spot is features at the very it features a number of circus animals, and I'll let Brian explain the significance of them later on. But at the very end, it's Dan Moody in front of a pile of stuff, and he says, "I'm going to need a bigger shovel."
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Everybody should go look at that. Theron, we talked, and tomorrow, because you're, I assume, going to end up coming down to cover this thing, we've talked on the show about the fact there are so many candidates in this race that it is possible you could get into a runoff. It was like 18. You get into a runoff with like 10, 11, 12% of the vote.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a bizarre race to watch unfold.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've been receiving a lot of questions about is, you know, the Democrats that are in the race, but let's just be fair. I mean, John Ossoff has raised a tremendous amount of money. Brian and I were talking during the break.
He's got a tremendous number of pledges. We haven't seen the money yet.
Right. Well, but when you have the RNC attacking a Democrat this early in the race with an ad that I think is hilarious, but it's very very Republican, like, you know, just really going off some things that voters really don't care about in the district. I mean, who cares that this guy likes Star Wars or not? People want good jobs.
It takes some old, like, college videos.
Yeah, they want quality education.
Yeah, we played parts of it on the air last Friday.
They want affordable health care. And so, you know, Republicans are just so out of touch. But listen, I agree with you, Bill. I think that someone in this runoff, I mean, someone can get in a runoff in this district, probably 10 or even less of that. I think it's going to be that close. Now, the other problem that people are having, like my good friend Bruce Lavelle, who's a
Republican,
who Brian's a big fan of, is, you know, how closely do you run to Trump in this district? Because he now is at a 40% disapproval rate nationwide and only won that district by one percentage point. So I think while Democrats, we have our challenges, I think Republicans have a lot of challenges as well.
It's one of these races where you have 18 candidates, it's impossible to poll. But the one polling question I would ask is I would want to know what Trump approval in the 6th district is.
Yeah. It's great with Republicans.
Well, Tamar, let me get...
Low.
It's great with Republicans.
Tamar, it seems to me, I know people, you know, you're seeing it up there, certainly. A lot of national media kind of focusing on this race as if it's going to tell us something about Trump's popularity, seeing this is an early indicator of that. I wonder if I were Democrats, if I wouldn't be cautious and nervous about having that attention focused on me, because after all, this still is a Republican district, yes?
Yes, but you are not hearing that trepidation up here. People, you know, Democrats seem to be very excited about it. There are young members of Congress up here who are saying, I want to plan my trip down there to campaign for John Ossoff. Rachel Maddow talks about it all the time. People seem really, really jazzed about this race.
Yeah, I think
it's so absurd.
I mean, yeah,
so,
I think that's wrong.
For Theron, Theron's talking about, you know, Republicans being detached from reality. I mean, this is a Democrat alternative universe where they are competitive in this race. John Ossoff may raise close to $4 million by the end of March, which is incredible. It's an eye-popping number. And it goes to what Tamara's saying, that there's a lot of energy on the Democrat side. They're very excited about it. But they're just so angry at Trump. They are just so committed to his utter destruction that they're going to shoot at every target. And this isn't a target. I love it. I am so thrilled that they're going to waste $4 million. I'm so glad that they're going to get their hopes up and then just get crushed into powder.
But aren't you happy we're not yelling, lock him up, at our rallies? I mean,
oh, it's coming, man. I mean, I hear about Jeff Sessions already. I mean,
Theron, it is interesting, Theron, to hear Tamar talk about how excited Democrats up there are, because it does seem to me that's a dangerous frame to put around this race.
Let me give Brian some credit. And by the way, Chief, you still owe me some bourbon, because I made a bold prediction on the show that David Perdue was going to win. So I forgot on that.
All right. We've got one minute to get this done.
The point that Brian is making, and he does, is very good, because he actually knows that this is still a Republican district. Conservatives still make up the overwhelming majority of voters there. But what I didn't hear him say, and let's just be fair here, a lot of this money that Ossoff is raising are coming from a lot of liberal groups. And so he is going to have to be very careful about not being painted as a liberal in this race. He's got to be a moderate to conservative Democrat.
All right. Theron Johnson gets the last word on today's show. Brian Robinson, thank you for being here. Theron, you know we love having you when you can get back here. Jim Galloway and Tamar Hallerman, thank you for being with us from Washington. Terrific opportunity to talk to all of you, so thanks for being with us. On Wednesday, enough of our blabbing. On Wednesday, it's your turn. On Wednesday, we're going to present to you another one of our citizen panels. Jenny Amond and Lisa Clark have spent a good amount of time going over all of the people who contacted us to say they'd like to be part of the show. We're going to be talking to those folks tomorrow evening and presenting that show to you on Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Galloway, we stop blabbing and let other people do it instead of us.
It's called a vacation.
It'll be fun, and I'm glad you're going to join me to talk to our panel. So that's coming up Wednesday at 2. In the meantime, that's it for us today. Thank you to everybody for listening to Political Rewind today. We'll see you Wednesday at 2.